Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. In the next hour, we're talking about water and the work being done by those striving to identify problems and solutions to some of the most pressing issues in lakes and oceans. Alexander Cousteau is among those working to draw attention to issues like preservation of ocean habitats, water scarcity, and pollution. The granddaughter of Jacques Cousteau, she has forged her own path in ocean conservation with international groups like Oceana and Blue Legacy. She has become a globally recognized advocate on water issues and was honored as a National Geographic Emerging Explorer in 2008. Cousteau joined me from Berlin earlier this week by Skype to talk about her family's legacy and her work. Alexandra, could you just share with our listeners a little bit about yourself and your work?
I am a National Geographic Emerging Explorer and a filmmaker and a speaker, and I work with different NGOs as an advisor, most notably Oceana, which is the world's largest nonprofit dedicated exclusively to ocean conservation. So we work in 8 different countries around the world and growing. And so there's a lot of travel, and there's a lot of advocacy, and there's a lot of making what I hope are convincing arguments for why we need to be more mindful with our care of the planet.
Okay. And I'm curious, too, how you made the connection with UW Superior, and you're going to be speaking at the Lake Superior Research Institute's 50th celebration.
So they reached out to me and invited me to join their celebration and speak at their event. And I deeply believe in the importance of independent research and specifically water research that can help us with more sustainable management of these resources that are important for all of us. And so it's a pleasure to be able to come and be part of the festivities and share some thoughts and learn, mostly. I'm excited about learning about what the Institute is doing and seeing Lake Superior for myself and meeting everybody, and it's going to be fun.
Okay. And, you know, obviously your grandfather is very well known, Jacques Cousteau. He was an explorer, yep. Conservationist, filmmaker, scientist, and the list goes on. So I'm imagining that you were very influenced by him as a child.
Yes, he was very influential for me. I learned to swim before I could walk, of course, and then he taught me to dive when I was 7. So between my introduction to the water world and the times that we spent in the Oceanographic Museum of Monaco and just on expedition and being together and talking about things, he had a big influence. How I see my place in it and in this conversation, and the importance of continuing to fight for our oceans and our water resources and our environment in general.
So is he the reason why you've kind of carried on your family's legacy, or what prompted you to do all of this work that you've been doing with Oceana and Blue Legacy and all of the projects that you're involved with?
Well, certainly he was an inspiration, but I think also I just grew up with this. You know, I went on my first expedition when I was 4 months old with my parents, and my father, Philippe, was working hand in hand with my grandfather. For me, it's just been a way of life. It's just been what we do. And there was never really any other option. You know, if you think about what you love to do in your spare time, you know, whether it's going hiking or spending time with your family or a log cabin in the woods or whatever it is, that's sort of what I do. I just do what I loved doing with my family as a child, and now I do it with my own children, and it's just always been that way.
So how did you carve out your own niche then, as far as the work that you've been doing on conservation and sustainable management of water?
It wasn't always easy. When I was younger, of course, people really associated me with my grandfather, and I was always introduced as his granddaughter. But over time, and I've been doing this 25 years, since I was 15, I started giving my own talks. And so I think now as an explorer with National Geographic and having done my own expeditions and my own films, and I've just kind of carved out my own space, and it's good. It feels good.
What is it that you're most passionate about, and what does your work center on mostly?
So my work's always been about oceans and water and telling those stories. But in the past few years, I've really shifted my focus from telling stories about all of the things that are happening in our world, the things that are alarming, things that we should know about, things we need to change, and focusing more on all the things that we're doing that are creating the kind of change we want to amplify. The people that are doing incredible things, the innovations that offer hope for solving some of these challenges, and the new ideas and all of the things that so many people around the world are doing to create the kind of change that we want to see. Because I realize that there's so much negativity around environmental issues. And it's heartbreaking, a lot of the things that are happening, and I feel that. But there's also a lot of hopeful things that are happening, and things that we should be talking about more because they offer a guide and a blueprint for how we can move into the future and move in the direction that we all want to move in, because we all want a more abundant, diverse future for our children, and we all want them to thrive in healthy, happy communities that can prosper from a sustainable use of our natural resources. And so, I think for me, I want to be able to be part of all of those exciting, innovative, successful things that are happening, and tell those stories and engage and inspire people to be part of that, rather than sounding the alarm, because honestly, it's just gotten, for me personally, with children, I want to look at the future, and I want to look at their future and all of our future in a hopeful, optimistic way. And in my position, when all you do is talk about everything that's not going well, it's really depressing. And so while I'm aware of those things, I think it's better for all of us if we start focusing on all the things that are going right and shining a light on those things, and offering the example to others of how that can be done.
Well, and what lessons do you think that our region, with the Great Lakes and 20% of the world's fresh water, what do you think that we can glean from the work that you've been doing, or that you hope people will take away from your message?
Well, I was in Vermont a couple of years ago, and we were looking at the impacts of runoff on Lake Champlain, and specifically agricultural runoff from dairy farms. And I went and I spoke with a dairy farmer who had inherited his family farm, but who had recently taken his whole operation organic. And it wasn't easy. But what was interesting about talking with him was that he talked about all the changes that he implemented on his farm with the help of government subsidies and nonprofits and just dozens and dozens and dozens of volunteers and members of his community, as something that has enriched his life in ways that he never could have imagined, because for the first time, his values and his actions are aligned. And when he looks at his farm that he's leaving to his children, he feels that he has enriched their experience of farming and the land that he's going to leave to them in unimaginable ways. And I think that while the Great Lakes are an amazing resource and are so deeply enriching to so many people and to recreation and the economy and agriculture and all these other things, I think that when we work together to improve things, just like that farmer, we experience a kind of community and a kind of coming together that we don't get in any other way. When we work together to improve our natural environment, it's really an experience unlike any other. And I've heard that over and over and over throughout the Great Lakes area, in Canada and in the United States. And that's anecdotal, of course, but it's always the same story. And that's really what I think is most hopeful, is that, in places where there's an abundance of water, but still a lot of problems, when communities come together to fix those problems together, there's a lot of improvement that can happen very quickly. And that brings people together in a special way.
So what are some of the tangible steps that you see that communities, whether they're here in the Great Lakes or along coastal communities bordering the ocean, what steps can they take to try and improve some of the challenges that are facing water right now?
Well, I've met people who started local water quality organizations around their kitchen table, and they do cleanups, they do water testing, they hold events to get other members of the community involved in understanding and conserving local resources, local streams, local rivers, local lakes. And those are always really fun because everybody gets to be part of it. Kids and grandparents and people meet each other that they never would have met otherwise. It's a really positive thing. And of course, there's a lot of good that can be done with landscaping. We're planting rain gardens. I met an older couple in Minneapolis who celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary by planting rain gardens for all of their neighbors. And a rain garden is where you plant certain plants in natural depressions on your property to absorb runoff from rainfall so that it doesn't wash pollutants from sidewalks and roads into local waterways. And those are very effective as well. So there's a lot that we can actually do that makes our communities more beautiful, that brings us together in new ways, that allows us to get out on our waterways and enjoy them and learn about them and learn about the wildlife that lives there and be able to watch in a very tangible way the improvement of those resources over time. And local organizations like the Institute are incredibly important in supporting those kinds of actions and helping people understand what the situation is, what the challenges are, what some of the solutions can be, and are important members of the community, I would say, in helping us preserve and protect our water resources.
Well, is there anything else that you want to add or that you hope people will take away from your speech coming up this week?
I think the most important thing that that any of us can do is initiate change in our own lives, of course, but also in our communities to be the kind of change that we want to see. And in my experience over and over and over again, that is an incredibly enriching thing to do. We often see this as a drain on our time or sacrifice, or we have to give things up to be able to, make these changes. But in reality, it's actually a really wonderful thing to do and a wonderful thing to share with your children and your neighbors and your friends. And I encourage everybody to reach out to your local water keeper or your local nonprofit or your local institute that's working on water quality issues in your community, and learn about what's going on and find out if there's a way that you can be involved.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, especially with all the challenges this morning. Thank you, Alexandra.
No worries. It's my pleasure.
Again, you were just listening to Alexandra Cousteau, National Geographic Emerging Explorer and keynote speaker for today's conference celebrating 50 years of the Lake Superior Research Institute at UW-Superior. Cousteau will speak this evening at 7 in Old Main's Thorpe Langley Auditorium at UWS. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll reflect on the Institute's research over the last 50 years with LSRI Director Matt Teneich. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. In this hour, we're talking about water and the work that's being done by those trying to identify problems and solutions to some of the most pressing issues in lakes and oceans today. Among them is Matt Teneich. He is the director of the Lake Superior Research Institute, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary today in an all-day conference at UW-Superior. The conference is being held in the Yellow Jacket Union at UWS and features sessions about past and present research by the Institute. Teneich sat down with me earlier this week to talk about his work and reflect on 50 years of research at LSRI. Can you start off by giving a little background about yourself and about the work that you do at the Institute?
Yeah, so I kind of like to say I'm kind of homegrown talent. I started here in the mid-90s as an undergraduate student. I was attracted to this university because of its small campus size, and it appeared to have a lot of opportunity for kind of hands-on research. There was stuff taking place all the time, and science students were involved. I graduated from here in 1998 with a biology degree, spent some time after that working with the DNR out of the Brule office, assessing fish habitat on streams along the south shore. I worked with a gentleman by the name of Bob Dubois. I went to Oklahoma State University for my master's degree. I was in the Department of Zoology and ended up working on some toxicity. So I was trying to understand a little bit about organic pollutants and how they behaved in soil, kind of in soil media, and I used the earthworm as my model there. I also had an opportunity to work at a watershed kind of scale in that north kind of eastern corner of Oklahoma. There's like four states that come together to a perfect point there. There's a mining district that used to harvest a bunch of metal from the earth used to make war machinery and equipment during the world's wars. It's no longer in use. The technique of mining was acid mining. The pits filled up with rainwater, and then it leached out into nearby streams. So it wasn't my project, but I worked with the team. My job was to try to catch fish to understand blood chemistry. We never caught any fish. The devastation was so much, so great there. So that was an interesting project, something that could translate, back to this area a bit. After that time, there was an opening back here. So the former director, Dr. Mary Balsar, had received a project, I think in about 2001, some substantial funding to monitor and sample all five of the Great Lakes. She was charged with looking at water quality as well as zooplankton health, the microscopic animals, and how they're behaving and what's the pattern and trends that we're seeing in the Great Lakes. So that was a five-year project, and that brought me back here as a researcher full-time. So I was happy to come back. I wanted to get back here. I wanted to provide students here at the university, undergraduate students, the same hands-on research experiences that I have. We're kind of like a little gem that sits in here in the northern part of Wisconsin that does some pretty amazing research projects, works on some pretty amazing things, and it's a great opportunity to provide students that may not otherwise get that opportunity, that chance. Students have been successful. So I was brought back here. I worked and managed the toxicity lab on campus. I was in McCaskill Hall before McCaskill Hall was demolished. I spent about 14 or 15 years just working as a researcher, a principal investigator, writing my own grants, working with others as co-PIs on project. I think I was able to bring in about $1.3 million in extramural funds just on my own projects, plus what we ever had, you know, as a team. About 2006, 2007, we started working on this ballast water issue. So when these ships come into the Duluth Superior Harbor, they bring in ballast water, and there could be potential invasive organisms in there. When they discharge their ballast water to take on cargo, those animals could be released. Policy was being set both at the national and international level, but there were some questions that needed to be addressed around that policy. There was no science provided. It was kind of a best guess, best professional judgment in setting those recommendations. So I set out to provide some of the first data to help, you know, potentially guide that policy. I approached researchers from the University of Minnesota Duluth with an idea about some experiments. They liked those ideas, and we took about 6 or 7 years to run that research. We had multiple funding sources, and at the end, I ended up with my dissertation out of that. So I received my PhD in 2015, and then a year after that, Mary Balsar had retired, and I was hired to become the director of this institute. So that brings you up kind of the current time, and now we're planning our 50th anniversary.
Yeah, so can you tell me a little bit about the history of the Lake Superior Research Institute and, you know, how things have changed over the years and where you're at today?
Yep, the institute started, obviously, in 1967. One of the first major projects that they had was trying to understand what type of vegetation would help minimize the red clay, the erosion that you see. So, you know, on a rainy day, if you travel across the bridge, you'll look over to the lake and you'll see the red clay plume that makes its way out there. There's some questions on, you know, what best practices, land management practices would help minimize that. And then they took those questions a bit further and tried to understand the impacts of that red clay on aquatic life. So that was one of the kind of the earlier studies, one of the bigger studies. I would say about the mid 80s or so, this institution was charged with setting water quality criteria and standards for both surface as well as drinking water. Right now, the water that you drink has some thresholds for the amount of pollutants that can be in there, both for aquatic life and as well as for water that is safe for you to drink. So this group here, it was probably a combination of 5 or 6 researchers, combed the literature, pulled all of the like data together for certain toxicants, and then wrote these water quality standards. They were used by the EPA, and the EPA looked, and, you know, if that water passed that threshold, there was some, you know, repercussions depending on, you know, who or what was causing that issue. In case where we didn't have enough data to make a water quality criteria standard, they would set advisories. So these would be recommendations. And it's simply because there just wasn't enough data. And I think out of here we had published about 60 of those advisories and criteria documents in total. That has some pretty profound reaches when you consider that everybody in the nation, you know, is abiding by those water quality criteria documents.
So that all started here at UW Superior.
Yep, that started here. Those documents. I mean, the EPA had to answer these questions. They were being held accountable, but that work was done out of this space here in cooperation with EPA. We have file cabinet upon file cabinet upon file cabinet of those raw papers that were pulled together to address and create those documents.
So I know you mentioned that ballast water research is a part of what you're doing here at the Lake Superior Research Institute. What makes up the vast majority of your research right now at this point in time?
So right now we have about 40 projects in total running. We have 21 staff members. One of the largest projects that we have, so it depends on how you define vast majority. The largest project that we have is a project we're calling the Green Shipping Initiative. It was a 5-year cooperative agreement signed between LSRI as well as the U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration. What we have been given is a cooperative agreement to continue on curtailing the spread of aquatic invasive species in ballast water. That's the foremost upfront mission with that grant and that project. They also want us to look at some other kind of green shipping activities. So, for example, if a ship was to convert from one type of diesel to another type of diesel, we may go out and measure the air emissions, or we could look at some other green shipping bilge water kind of issues that may be installed in these ships. The biggest part of that is that effort on understanding the spread of invasive species, all with a focus in the Great Lakes region. That's our largest project, but we also have projects in numbers. They're smaller, but we have many of them. We've had an ongoing project with multiple tribal agencies where we will get in fish tissue, wild rice tissue, and then a lab will analyze that tissue and look at mercury and metal concentrations in there. We take that data and we give it back to the tribes, and then they set consumption advisories for ceded territories. That's been decades worth of ongoing research for that as well.
And that's really important to them because they subsist off of what they gather, hunt, fish, and gather.
Right. It's also, depending on the situation, can also be used as background data. So kind of the pre and post mining issue, pre-implementation of a mine, you can collect this information and understand what the natural levels are, the common, background levels are. If a mining situation goes in and mines happen, you can also take a look during as well as after and have kind of a cause and effect relationship that's documented. They have that advantage by collecting these long-term data sets. We collect that data for them. They provide us often the tissues, the fish fillets, the wild rice, and then we do the analysis here on campus. All of our projects use students, and it's one of our missions here is this university is very good at providing students with opportunities to do more than just learning in a classroom or in a traditional lab. We have a lot of opportunities for students to gain hands-on research experiments. Working with the researcher, they learn responsibility, they learn how to collect high-quality data, they understand what standard operating procedures are. So when they graduate and they leave here, they are highly marketable for graduate school as well as jobs and internships beyond this.
So when you talked about some of the projects that you're working on right now, you talk about all the work that you're doing here at the Institute. What are the challenges to being able to do that work as far as resources or funding?
Yeah, that's a good question. as administrations change, both at the state and federal level, I mean, there's no question now that we're really living in a period of uncertainty. If you pay attention with federal budgets coming out, the impacts on the EPA, the impacts on other federal agencies that we typically receive funding from or, compete for, they've been cut. And I think it's been even more of a challenge because we don't know. That's the problem. And being cut, you can handle and manage and look for other things. But this period of uncertainty, it's a bit of a challenge. So it's forced us. It's forced us to kind of diversify our funding portfolio. My institution alone subsists on extramural funding. So we have 21 people, full-time employees, and we only have two positions supported by state funding. The rest of us are project basis. And I think, just so for this anniversary coming up, we tabulated all of the grants and projects that we've worked on. It's been over 600 different projects since 1967, and we've brought in well over $60 million worth of extramural funds to keep us all going.
From the state and federal government?
And private, as well as tribal. So it's a wide variety, a huge list of funders that have supported us over the years. So back to your question is what do we do now? Is we just got to be flexible and nimble and diversify. So we provide services to the private sector as well. So there are people that are developing companies, developing new projects that may have to have environmental testing on a product. We provide those services. You know, from this region, microbrews and small breweries are popping up all over the place. They need to have certification analysis on water quality, and it needs to be done by a certified lab. We are one of the only labs this far north that's certified to do microbial testing as well as some water quality testing. That helps these folks tremendously because they don't have to ship samples to Madison or to Kansas or, you know, wherever they may need to go. So that's been a new area for us. We just received those certifications this summer. It was a lengthy process to go through, review, update standard operating procedures, and make sure that we met, you know, all of the requirements for the state of Wisconsin.
How does that impact the people you serve?
It helps them immensely. It provides them another resource to send their samples to. You know, so we are local. We can work with them face to face. We can provide the students, so there's an indirect benefit to them. Students get training. We can help them collect their samples. Often we can be cheaper because there's no shipping cost. The turnaround time is much shorter. You don't have to ship a sample somewhere else, wait for it to be analyzed, and then return the data. So there's benefits that way.
For someone who isn't familiar with the work that you do, or maybe this is the first time they're hearing of the Lake Superior Yep. Research Institute, why is the work so important? How does it impact the region?
It's important because we live on one of the world's largest freshwater resources, you know, in the world. We use the water for drinking. We use the water for sport and recreation purposes. So we're here to help do that. We also very much conduct applied research. So at the end of our projects, there's always a deliverable, something that can either be used by the citizens, by society, by managers, by regulators that may need some specific questions addressed. We can do that. We also provide training for students, so that education aspect is very beneficial to folks. I'd also like to think that, you know, we're here for the region, but we also serve customers well beyond the region. We're a global group. Much of our projects take us, you know, beyond the local boundaries, as well as our students. We've had many international students work with us. Some of them are going to actually come back and speak at the conference on Friday. We have one female that was a student. She was in Africa. She's in Canada working in her own business. She's going to come back and on Friday and talk to us about Hawk, where her experiences set her for a career to help do what she's doing now. So,
if people come to the conference then,
yeah.
What do you hope that they take away from what you present or what they learn about the Lake Superior Research Institute?
I think the big message is for them to know that we've been in existence for 50 years. We're doing some pretty amazing things. We often don't market ourselves very well because of the way we're structured and, you know, some of the things that happen. It's been a benefit sometimes for us as well as a bit of a hindrance because we're in people's backyards and this may be the first time they're truly hearing about us. So I hope that they know that we're here, and I hope that they realize we're doing some pretty amazing things at a very small campus. You know, we're doing world-class research. And then to let them know that we have a new vision, and we're looking for setting a new mission and a new strategy going forward, because we are in this period of change with funding and so on. So we'll get to hear a little bit about that, and I do believe our future is pretty bright, and it's looking pretty hopeful, and that we will be in existence for at least another 50 years, and if not longer, doing some pretty amazing things.
Well, I guess kind of related to your new vision, are there any new projects that you're taking on or just beginning this fall, and anything that you're wrapping up?
So we are wrapping up a bacteria project. It's called we call it the bacterial source tracking. So there are a variety of beaches in Wisconsin as well as in Minnesota, the North and South Shore, that are either impaired or become impaired due to high levels of bacteria throughout the summer. This project was in the cooperation with Wisconsin DNR, and the staff working on that would go out and sample a few times a week and after high rain events, and they would take a look at concentrations of bacteria in the water, as well as do beach surveys. So they would stand on the shores of that beach and look around and see, are there dogs running loose, or are there geese on the shore? What is the vegetation structure like? Measure water quality in the beach. And if they had to close the beach, they would, get the data and make recommendations. But ultimately, they would provide guidance on possibly where the source of bacteria contamination is coming from, as well as if there's any recommendations to minimize that. Or change it so that our beaches stay open longer, during those periods of time. One can imagine that during our high tourism time, if beaches are closed due to bacterial contaminations, there might be a societal impact. People can't swim, tourism dollars may not be generated, and so on. So getting a hold of that and understanding that is beneficial. So we collect that data. They turn those results over to the DNR, and they're working through the final recommendations right now.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, one that will definitely make an impact on the Lake Superior beaches. I know people hate to see it when it's closed. So.
Yep, absolutely.
Anything else that you're starting right now?
No, I think we talked about them. We mentioned the ongoing the green shipping project. They're finishing that up. That's ongoing, so that'll be another 4 years of that project. So it's in its infancy. It's a large project, multi-million dollar adventure there. So it consumes a lot of our time pulling that together and then executing that project. There's a lot.
Okay. And more to come in the future.
Yes.
And thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me about the Lake Superior Research Institute, and happy 50th.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Again, you were just listening to Matt Teneich, director of the Lake Superior Research Institute at UW-Superior. The Institute is celebrating its 50th anniversary today. You can learn more about it and its work online at uwsuper.edu. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll bring you news of the week as covered by the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we take a look back on news of the week, as covered by the KUWS news team. Overall, student enrollment is up 3% at UW-Superior this fall. UWS Chancellor Renee Wachter says they're seeing the largest growth in students pursuing a graduate degree.
Which I think says a couple of things. Number one, we were sort of thinking strategically about how to meet the needs of the region. Because it's an innovative program delivery, it provides access to a lot of people who couldn't access those programs if they had to come in a traditional campus setting. In fact, our director of the program said she's gotten several unsolicited emails from people saying, thank you so much for offering this program. There's no way I could have been able to come to a campus. I'm so grateful for giving me this opportunity to advance in my career. So we're excited about that.
Graduate student enrollment is up by 71% this fall. It's the first time the university has enrolled more than 200 graduate students since 2010. At the same time, the number of first-year undergraduate students was slightly below the university's five-year average of 350. Wachter says that's to be expected with fewer high school graduates in Wisconsin.
We saw a slight dip, but that really meant that we were just going back to 2014 levels. So we know that that's endemic of this entire region, where we're not going to see an increase in a population of high school students until the year 2023.
Wisconsin has seen a 9% drop in the number of high school graduates over the last 7 years, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. There are 2,569 students attending UWS this fall. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and as Elizabeth McMahon reports, the Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse says police have received about 30% more domestic violence calls in the last several years.
Law enforcement has seen a growing number of calls to report domestic violence over the past 3 years. That's according to Jill Hinners with the Center Against Sexual and Domestic Abuse, or CASDA, in Superior. She says police have received 418 calls in 2013 compared to 585 calls last year. Hinners says the signs of domestic violence can sometimes be difficult to spot.
Often the public face that you see on an individual or a couple is not necessarily what's going on behind closed doors. If people don't understand the dynamics of domestic violence and why it's so hidden and why it can be so hard for a victim of domestic violence to break free, they don't really understand some of those barriers as well as signs to watch out for.
Hinner says domestic violence can exist in many forms, whether it's physical abuse, emotional abuse, or controlling someone financially. She says CASDA staff members have been working to educate children and adults about the differences between healthy and unhealthy relationships across the community.
We would love it, right, if the whole community showed up for our trainings and really dug in, but there's so many smaller ways that someone can get involved. You know, they can do their regular grocery shopping and throw a package of paper towel in their cart for CASDA. While supplies last, we'll be handing out purple flags just to draw awareness to domestic violence. And even if someone is able to just plant a purple flag in their yard or at their business to highlight Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
CASDA offers a 10-bedroom facility for people who need a place to stay after leaving an abusive relationship. Hinner says they house people for up to 45 days or more. Elizabeth McMahon, Wisconsin Public Radio.
CASDA's fall donation drive is already underway and runs through this weekend at Super One on Superior's East End. CASDA's 24-hour helpline can be reached at 1-800-649-2921. The Richard I. Bong Veterans Historical Center celebrated its 15th anniversary this week. Olivia Shalaby has more.
Bong Historical Center Executive Director Hayes Scriven says the museum was built in 2002 to preserve and honor Major Bong's memory and World War II veterans. He says lately they've been working on gathering stories to honor all veterans in the Northland.
Which is one thing we're pushing right now pretty heavily, because we want to be able to capture as many veteran stories as possible. Specifically, we've been working with some local outlets here on capturing Vietnam veteran stories. So we've been doing that, but just kind of, and then we collect artifacts and objects and paper memorabilia, photos of veterans.
Scriven says there are more than 4,000 veterans in Douglas County alone. He hopes people will understand and appreciate the different experiences of veterans who serve in the military.
Nobody else is going to experience what they experience. So for the general public to come to a place like this and read these stories or hear these stories, it's a very powerful thing for them, because they're never going to be able to experience anything like, you know, a certain veteran experience in Vietnam. So for them to understand what they went through and what they were thinking, we hope that they'll come away with a better appreciation of what these veterans have went through serving in our military.
Scriven says in coming years, they want to focus more on community-centered events and social gatherings in the community. He says they're also working on expanding their educational outreach to students in the area. Olivia Shelaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has sold about 40% of the land it put up for sale to help pay down around $617 million in debt in the state's stewardship program. The 2013-2015 state budget directed the DNR to put at least 10,000 acres up for sale by this past July. So far, the agency has sold almost half to private landowners, the general public, tribes, and local units of government. Bayfield County Forestry Administrator Jason Bodine says the county bought just under 200 acres from the state in Bayfield.
So it'll be part of that county forest block. So from a timber production standpoint, there's a really good potential. There's well-established recreational trails that run through the property already.
Bodine says the county is finalizing the deed with the state. Jim Lemke with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says tribal and local governments have purchased about 36% of the land so far. The agency will continue to market the remaining land for sale over the next year. The Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa will begin tracking two wolf packs in the Bayfield Peninsula this fall. Red Cliff wildlife and forestry biologist Jeremy St. Arnold says they will use satellite collars to track wolf movements.
We are interested in how the wolves were using the reservation and how they were using timber harvest as well. We're interested in their use of the islands because we've documented through VHF collars that they have gone out there.
Arnold says the satellite collars will relay wolf coordinates every 25 minutes. He says right now they've only been able to track movements once a week with data from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
And that will give us much finer scale data on the movements of those wolves. And when we get clusters from those points, we can then go and then investigate those clusters and find out if it's a kill site, a den site, a rendezvous site.
Arnold says they want to know if wolves are harassing farms or bear dogs. He says they hope to minimize wolf conflicts and learn as much as possible.
Wolves are a very important species to the tribe. The tribe looks at the wolf as their brother. Very polarizing animal.
Arnold says they'll be collaring wolves this fall with the help of a $75,000 grant from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Bayfield, a city with the population of just under 500, is expecting around 60,000 people to show up this weekend to celebrate Applefest. Olivia Shalaby has more on how the city will be celebrating their agricultural heritage and expectations for this year's festival.
This year marks the 56th annual Bayfield Apple Festival. Kaylee Lenahan with the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau says around 150 vendors will offer everything from apples to arts and crafts. Lenahan says people who are going to Apple Fest for the first time should get there early.
Well, I would say, if possible, try to get here on Friday. That is the day that, obviously, it's the day that the festival starts, and that day we traditionally see the least amount of crowds, so it's a great way to familiarize yourself with the festival and not have to contend with heavy crowds.
Lenahan encourages people to sample as much food from vendors as possible to get a taste of what Bayfield has to offer.
All of our food vendors are encouraged to incorporate apple foods into their offerings. And so there's all different kinds of apple foods, everything from caramel apples and apple pies to apple brats and apple chili.
Lenahan says the festival will also include live bands and a carnival.
So on Saturday, we have our apple peeling contest, which is a really fun event. Participants have 1 hour to create the longest apple peel that they can, and in fact, they do take that entire hour.
Lenahan says Apple Fest will begin on Friday and wrap up with a grand parade on Sunday afternoon, which will include 9 high school bands and roughly 500 students. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Vendors will be at Apple Fest on Friday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. The grand parade begins at 2 on Sunday afternoon. If you head to Bayfield and you've had your fill of apples for the day, you can also head to the Stone Lake Cranberry Fest. That's the same day, October 7th. They typically have more than 30,000 people every year, and lots of people go to both festivals, so keep that on your calendar as well. They're expecting more than 300 vendors, and events there kick off at 9 a.m. and run through 5 o'clock on Saturday. On a serious note, the shootings in Las Vegas this week left a horrific number of people killed and wounded, yet authorities haven't called it an act of terrorism. Commentator Robin Washington looks at the meaning of the word terrorism and discovers it has different definitions depending on where and when you ask.
By now, you probably know the facts. Stephen Paddock booked a room on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel. He brought in an arsenal of weapons and shot into an outdoor concert, killing 58 and wounding nearly 500. What we don't know yet is why he did it. Authorities say they aren't looking at terrorism, at least until they know what Paddock's political beliefs were. That's because of how terrorism is largely defined. The FBI calls it the use of force or violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government in furtherance of political or social objectives. Merriam-Webster also invokes a political motivation, defining it as the use of violent acts to frighten as a way of trying to achieve a political goal. That's a relatively new definition. The edition of Webster's on my desk from 1994 says, the systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. No mention of political motivation. The same is true for a 1961 unabridged edition. The word evokes different feelings as well. It originated in a Latin term, terror imbricus, describing panic that preceded an attack on ancient Rome. During the French Revolution, Robespierre and his compatriots proudly called themselves terrorists when ordering their daily beheadings during the Reign of Terror. Only in more recent times has it become a pejorative. Dueling sides in a conflict will lob the terrorist label at each other while calling themselves freedom fighters. If dictionaries have contradictions, so do law books. A Nevada statute defines terrorism as an act of sabotage or coercion or violence, again, without mentioning political motivation. So was Paddock a terrorist, whatever he believed? Clearly, he had some issue with society, which he apparently sought to resolve by committing mass murder. No one word will bring back those who tragically lost their lives, but failing to call terrorism what it is won't make us any safer.
Robin Washington comments regularly for KUWS and writes for the Pulitzer Prize-winning criminal justice website, The Marshall Project. That's online at themarshallproject.org. This has been Wisconsin Public Radio's Week in Review, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. And you can hear us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. And this has been Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.